In this episode, one of the most remarkable interviews you've heard in a long time. I'm Trevor Dan. Buckle up for a roller coaster ride with Gambo.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Hello. Next month, Paul Gambaccini will leave his long-running America's Greatest Hits programme to take over Radio 2's Pick of the Pops from his former colleague Tony Blackburn. Some people have seen a rich irony in Gambo's redemption seeming to come at the expense of his friend. But as you'll hear, there's much, much more to the story than that. After the dismissal of the cases against him brought under Operation U-Tree and his return to the BBC, you might expect the veteran broadcaster to be keeping his head down. But no. Here he is, talking to me in his penthouse flat on London's South Bank, as outspoken as ever. Letting BBC senior management have it with both barrels. Well, Gambo, congratulations on taking over the great British icon that is Pick of the Pops. How are you feeling about that?
Well, of course, I have mixed feelings. It was the first programme that I remember hearing when I came to this country in October 1970. And at my first Sunday night in Oxford, I was looking for a place to eat because the hall was not open. And I found a Chinese restaurant, and they were playing Alan Freeman's Pick of the Pops. Now, just think about that. A Chinese restaurant was playing Alan Freeman's Pick of the Pops. And that is the extent of his coverage. As you know, he peaked at 20 million listeners because he was up against the God Block on TV, and nobody was watching. Well, except the devout. And it was the first program I heard, the first program I loved. I adored Alan Freeman. And I've happily said on many occasions that in my mind, I've been inspired by him, although people may find it hard to see exactly what it is I've taken from him. But he was a giant of the profession. And then, of course, recently we had another giant of the profession, Tony Blackburn. So I'm following in the footsteps of some illustrious predecessors.
I want to talk to you about radio, about Tony and some of the issues that have emerged recently. But I wondered if I could just pick up the very end of your book, Love PG, where you talk about Britain, your adopted home. And you just mentioned that you came to study at Oxford, and that's a very long time ago. And as we sit here in your eyrie, you know, overlooking London, I wonder whether you still feel that this is home or whether you feel that Britain has in some way let you down as it thrust you into that vortex of despair over U-Tree and the rest.
The people of Britain have not let me down at all. Twice a day, on average, I'm stopped in the street by someone who says either thank you for your book or we're behind you all the way or good luck. I mean, it's astonishing. Even when I was on bail, people were always supportive around the country. So the people of the country I still believe in and love. But of course, my faith in the there was a group in All Star Comics once called the Injustice Society of America. My belief in the Injustice Society of Britain has faded, and I tend to see the leading figures of the police and Crown Prosecution Service as one would leading figures of the Injustice Society of America, such as the Psycho Pirate. I've lost my belief. It's that simple. I came to love this country more than any other. I chose to live here. I've said it in the book, nobody loves a country as much as someone who chooses to live in it. I recommend it to my friends in America. They come and live here. I can no longer make that recommendation. I know too much. What a drag.
And we're having this conversation, Paul, on the day that the Birmingham bombings are back in the news. We've recently had Hillsborough, we've had Orgreave, not to mention all the other kind of BBC scandals, which suggests that society was not as properly run as it might have been. Do you think we've learned from any of this?
If the Metropolitan Police had learned from my case, there would have been no Operation Midland. Because the number one lesson from my case was, or should have been, do due diligence on the accuser. Before you go into somebody's house in great numbers, check out the guy making the accusation. And as you know, in Midland, it turns out that the guy making the accusation was what I prefer to call a distressed individual. That covers a lot of ground. Well, it turns out that my accuser was a distressed individual. And it's so annoying because after the case is over, you find out more than you were let on during the case. And I discovered that amongst the many things that should have stopped them from launching my case was that the story of my accuser included him, you're going to love it, ringing the doorbell of my flat, which supposedly was answered by a number one pop star who told him to F off. Now, I didn't know this when I was arrested, but when I found out months later, because this person told me, I just thought, how did he get in? I mean, he never lived there. Did he scale the building like Spider-Man? And if they'd only gone to him, if the police had only gone to him beforehand and said, did you ever answer Paul Gambaccini's door and tell a visitor to F off? And he would have said, as he did say when he was interviewed by them, no. That should have just made them say, okay, let's proceed very carefully here. And that's exactly what happened with Operation Midland. They didn't do their due diligence on the accuser. Result, self-imposed reputational damage that will take a generation to recover from. And I feel sorry for, as I say in the book, to me about 90% of police officers are good, honest, hardworking people. But these good, honest, hardworking, rank-and-file people are made to do bad things by their leaders. And the whole witch hunt was basically a wild goose chase with hardly any geese. And the more you know about it, and the general public will never know the full extent of it because they only know the cases that reached the arrest stage, plus Cliff and Operation Midland. They don't know some of the other people who were kept on tenterhooks for months or a year on stories that were even more ludicrous than ours.
The insidious thing for me, Paul, is that some of your friends and colleagues, me included, were conflicted about this because our first reaction is, no, not Paul, not Gambo. And then you find that awful second reaction, which is, oh, well, maybe I didn't know him as well as I thought, and maybe there is some truth in this, and no smoke without fire, and if I stand up and say, I don't believe these accusations, this man is as honest as the day is long, I might end up looking silly, and my relationship with the BBC and other important people in my life might take a turn for the worse. That's a terrible thing that, in a sense, I think some of us did to you.
Well, thank you for admitting your humanity. But you see, there's one important word you used when you said, maybe there is something to this. And the point is, you didn't know what this was. And the way it was presented in all of the pre-Cliff cases was the expression historic sexual offenses. So it could have been anything, and you don't know how many times. Now, if you had known what my case was about, you wouldn't have believed it for 1 second. Because it involved, it's in my book. It involved having overlapping 3-year affairs with two people I've never known in the decade before I even started having same-sex relations. Hello, you can't be more than 100% wrong. I would suggest to Bernard Hogan Howe that before he arrests somebody on suspicion of having sex with them, make sure the people know each other. You can't have sex with someone unless you know them. Now, you are not alone, as R. Kelly and Michael Jackson would say.
Did you feel a bit let down, I guess is what I'm getting at here? Did some people sort of disappear?
Well,
when they could have been making supportive noises?
Not in my innermost circle of family and friends, because they just knew from day one it was nonsense. I mean, my husband, Chris, when I came back that night with the list of accusations, and he looked at it, and what's his reaction? Fear? No. Horror? No. He laughed, and he said, you don't even do these things to me. The whole thing was a joke, except it wasn't. Now, here's where, and I've mentioned this before, so I'm not making a dramatic accusation. As you know, from the moment I was arrested, no member of senior management, meaning above radio level, spoke to me. So I spoke to Helen on down, as it were. But none of the inner coterie of management got in touch to say, what is this about? They just took me off. And kept me off. And never asked, and to this date have never asked, what was that about? And of course, which is very amusing when you've worked for somebody for 40 years, nobody said, are you all right? You know, so, I mean, I do think that does qualify the BBC for the Worst Employer of All Time award. You can serve somebody for 40 years, and then you're falsely accused of something, and nobody even bothers to ask if you're okay. Now, but what is really serious, and will be written about in the years to come, as people pick all the flesh off these bones, is that nobody from upper management wanted to know. Because this followed on from Entwistle. And when Savile broke, and I'd been the first one to talk about him, which could be why I was accused, by the way, because since I had been the first, my picture was on the front page of all the tabs, juxtaposed next to Savile.
And you were known for being outspoken about the BBC, because you'd done it about Ross Brand as well, hadn't you?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a possibility that, you know, as I was so horrified when I saw that the police had invited members of the public to accuse celebrities saying you will be believed, and I thought, well, my picture's just been on the front page next to Jimmy Savile, excuse me. If all it takes is one guy, a distressed individual, I'm in trouble. Because someone's going to add up two and two and get four, and they did, and after 5 months, as I later found out, I'd been investigated for 5 months without my knowing it. They dropped the case, the famous insufficient evidence. And then some other officer comes on the case, wants to rev it up again, and so they go to somebody else and invite him to accuse me. They say he did. He says he didn't. They won't provide any text or video to support their contention that he did. And so until the end of my days, unless they show me a manuscript or a video in which the second person accuses me, I'll have to assume that my arrest was not only wrongful but illegal. However,
can I just pull you back to the radio business?
Yes,
and the business of the BBC.
Yeah, this is the BBC. This is the BBC.
You say they're a bad employer.
Well, because the BBC is no longer like a Japanese company where you rise from within and then take over, being a DG or an upper manager of the BBC now is a step on one's individual career ladder. People go in and out of sectors. I mean, poor old Tim Davey, he's the avatar of this. But everybody recently has just hopped from sector to sector, which means there is no BBC anymore. There's just whoever happens to be running it at the moment. This is heartbreaking. And so the person who runs it at the moment and his inner coterie decide what their policy is going to be. And that is the policy of the BBC. Forget about what it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, let alone 40. You know, I'm old man River here. I just keep moving along. So with Entwistle, I was waiting for the call. What is this about? You know, you were there, what was Savile like? You know, did this really happen? Nothing. And then when I saw him lawyered up in front of that Home Affairs Select Committee, I thought, oh, that's it. He didn't want to know everything. He wanted to know nothing. I mean, George, excuse me if I'm misrepresenting you, but I think the lawyer's position probably was, don't try to know everything, try to know nothing. Because if you know something, you can be accused of concealing it. But if you don't know it, you can't conceal it. So we get to the era of T. Hall and his little group, and no one calls me up to ask what this is about. And to this day, they probably don't know what it's about. Now, imagine how far away I feel from a management group like that, when they're just happy to throw me over the side for their own image. And this is one of the changes in evolution of the BBC that I've witnessed in my time. And of course, I can't protest it because I have zero hard power. I mean, any power I have is soft power. It comes from the affection of my long-term listeners, and I rely on that to try to get support for law change that we need to have. You know, so...
Do you think, Paul, that the same thing that happened to you has happened with Tony? I mean, Tony Blackburn is the most honest and open person I can imagine. I can't imagine Tony dissembling or lying, can you? He's just as transparent as they come. And yet, the minute there's some kind of flavour of possibility of something, off he goes.
You have invited me to comment in an area in which I could very easily lose my temper. So suffice it to say that I should report rather than vent. And I will simply report that I have worked in my 43 years for every BBC network except for Five Live, which I've appeared on. And never in those 43 years have I known a network to be united as Radio 2 is united in support of Tony Blackburn. You will hear the expression, the wrong Tony was sacked. And that is the unanimous feeling, with the possible exception of the controller, whom I've not spoken to. That's basically because he didn't speak about this. So we're in a very awkward situation. And I have, of course, spoken to Tony Blackburn on several occasions. And before I knew I was even in the frame to do the show, when Mark Goodyear was depping, Tony made it clear to me that his grievance is not with his colleagues, whom he understands have to earn a living, but with the management and the director general. And then, when to my incredulity, I was asked to do the show, I again spoke to Tony. And he again made it clear that he wishes me well, personally.
I'm glad to hear that, because there's been a little bit of flack, hasn't there, in the blogosphere about, well, that's a rum thing for Gambo to do, to profit from Tony's problems.
I would never have done it. And I mean that. A, this was not one of my career goals. I was happy doing America's Greatest Hits, which I've done for 41 years, and in which I suddenly realized after they told me it was coming off, you know what? That is the longest-running single-presenter popular music show in the history of the country. Okay, you can take 6 years off for the interval, if you wish, which would make it 35 years. But nonetheless, Alan Keith had 44 years with his classical program, Your 100 Best Tunes. And in America, Oscar Brand sails on in his 72nd year with his folk music program on WNYC. He is now 96 years old. But it's extraordinary.
You're going to miss that?
Well,
you're bound to, aren't you?
I would miss it in the same sense that I would miss anything that I do every week. But also in that it was as true a projection of myself as there can be. So I now face a very different challenge, which is to do an entertainment program in which I do not play modern music for the first time in my career, which began on WDCR, Hanover, New Hampshire, in December 1966, so we're coming up on 50 years. And I became a DJ in 67, and since then, until today, I've always played some current music. And that will stop. Which is part of the evolution of Radio 2. It happened to Johnny first. So Bob is the only veteran now who left who gets to do that. We've all talked about this. But I recognize, you see, I learned during my year on bail, you have to desperately cling to positives, look for positives to motivate you. So what are the positives on my losing America's Greatest Hits and gaining Pick of the Pops? Okay, I get my Saturday nights back. I'm back on Saturday afternoons, which I traditionally was. And I have more listeners as a result of that. And because there's one more Pick of the Pops program per year than America's Greatest Hits, because we used to get preempted by Eurovision, I will, in effect, have a 2% rise in an era where nobody gets any rises. So from that point of view, it's a clean sweep. And also, I cannot put in more than a quarter of the time and energy I put in on America's Greatest Hits because the charts already exist. I can't listen to all the new records and think, which ones am I going to play? The charts already exist. Now, with Tony Blackburn, I will have to return because I felt the very first day, well, I got a call at 11:30, just before going to bed. You know, this is what I hate, you know, the late night call, just when you're going to go to bed. You know, I mean, God bless Michael Jackson, but he died at the wrong time. Anyway, moving right along. 11:30, I get a call from Five Live. Would you like to go on Nikki Campbell in the morning to talk about Tony Blackburn being sacked? And I said, well, no. insufficient data. What's happened? And I said, well, it's in the Mirror. It was in the Mirror first. So I look it up. And, of course, I get so upset that I can't fall asleep until 2. I know the phone's going to start ringing off the wall at 7. The phone starts ringing off the wall at 7. And everybody, to the Today Show, Newsnight, the Daily Mail, the Guardian, I mean, everybody. And I know they just want me to condemn the Director General. I mean, I know that's why they're calling. But I can't condemn anybody without knowing what's going on. At 10 to 10 that morning, I got a call from Kevin Howlett, my producer on America's Greatest Hits, saying a friend of his had phoned him to say that my show had been repeated in the middle of the night in place of Tony Blackburn, Pick of the Pops. No one had told either of us, nor our editor. And, of course, no one had asked me, how do you feel about this? And if I'd been asked, do we have your permission to put your program out in place of Tony Blackburn, of course I would have said no. But I know, having no hard power, thanks to John Burt, once you've done a program, you get no repeat fees, and it's the property of the BBC, and they don't even have to tell you when it goes out again. I can't tell you how many people, by the way, have told me how much they've loved my David Bowie series, which we did at Radio 1 in the early 90s and has been repeated on Six Music and elsewhere, without my knowing it. It's very bizarre when that happens.
It's happened to me with 25 Years of Rock, which I made 30 years ago.
Yes, there you are. And that was an iconic program. They should at least tell you, you know. So anyway, and John Byrne, here's an interesting statistic. They've come to arrest him. it just occurred to me a couple of years ago that in my life I have earned 20% less because of John Byrne, because it was he who ended repeat fees. And, of course, most of my programs are repeated. My Radio 2 and Radio 4 programs are repeated. Now I get no repeat fees. So in my life, I've earned 20% less. They're taking them away now. Yeah. Yeah, if he hears this and would like to compensate me, it's okay. But anyway, this is one of the things you live with. You see, you have no hard power as a presenter. You just have to adapt to the situation in which you find yourself. As Steve Wright put it perfectly, we surf the controllers. Okay, for controllers read management as well. I mean, the controllers come, the controllers go, the DGs come, the DGs go. If you're blessed with a long career, you just have to tough it out, or maybe you have 5 years of glory before somebody else comes in. You just have to surf them. And
I'm going to push
but back to Tony. Yeah. But back to Tony. Okay. Back to Tony. So came 4 o'clock on the day. Still, people from the BBC, from Radio 2, had not been informed, although it was everywhere in the press. And so I called, and I left a message. It went to voicemail, and I said, is there any reason I should not go on the Today program tomorrow morning and denounce the Director General? Because everybody's asking me to denounce the Director General. And the wrong Tony's been sacked. Nobody got back to me. And to this day, there was never an explanation offered to the staff or presenters as to why it had happened. We had the Director General go to the Dame Janet news conference where he explained it in his own inimitable way, kowtowing as he did before the witch hunters of the press. But then again...
And he was worried about charter renewal, surely.
Sure. But you see, like many bad generals, Tony Hall fought the last war. The last war was Savile. The BBC lost that war. The new war was the attempt to discredit the BBC through the persecution of its veteran presenters. He did not defend us. This was a new war. He was happy to throw us all over the side to de-Savilize the BBC. And the only reason I'm willing to say this now, you know, and I'm saying it to you, and I'm trying to say it in a way which is not personal, because nobody wants a lawsuit. This is why I refer to the management or the coterie, because I don't seek a lawsuit, and I don't seek to focus on one individual when three may suffice. But you see...
You're incorrigible, Gambo.
But they've been on the wrong side of this from the get-go. They've been on the wrong side of the witch hunt from the get-go. And in my book, I actually said the BBC has acquiesced in totalitarianism. Now, I realize that sounds like an extreme thing to say, but when you are living extreme life day after day, the extreme actually becomes commonplace. And when they kept me off for a year without even asking me what it was about, at the time, I had other things to worry about, so I wasn't going to raise a stink. But looking back on it, I think, you know, that is really the pits of employer-employee relations. But then, of course, the cliff episode, which was the low point in the history of the BBC, until 3 weeks later, when the Director General and, I believe, the news director went in front of the Home Affairs Select Committee and defended it. That was the new low in the
This was the BBC announcing that there was going to be this raid on Cliff's house.
Yeah, broadcasting the raid on Cliff's house. And those of us in the falsely accused community, if we may use modern jargon, knew why the South Yorkshire police were doing this.
Oh, South Yorkshire. Fancy that.
Fancy the fact that it's South Yorkshire, who'd given you Rotherham and Hillsborough and Orgreaves. You know, I mean... this wonderful bunch of honest people, one of whom became Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. Anyway, so it was the first time that an expression other than historic sexual offences had been used, and that was because we knew they didn't have enough on Cliff to arrest him, so they wanted somebody to accuse him of exactly the same thing as the first person. And then there would be a pattern of behavior. And so this raid was carried out with the maximum of publicity so they could get something else on Cliff. Well, certainly they were not going to get anything in his house, which had been his... I mean, he'd bought the place after the alleged episode. It was 150 miles away from the alleged episode. The episode was before the invention of computers. Anything they would seize in his house... I mean, the most they would find would be back issues of Casper the Friendly Ghost and the Bible in several translations. But they did that to entice someone to make an accusation. And the BBC took the role of Pravda in the Soviet Union and acted as the recruiting agency for the police. I don't know if this is true or if the representative of the Dame Janet Committee was misspeaking. But I was not asked to speak to the Dame Janet Committee, well, in other words, the Dame Janet, before I was arrested, nor while I was on bail. But then after I was dismissed, I get a call from an assistant of Dame Janet. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name, but it was a phone call rather than a letter. And she said, would you like to testify, or whatever they're calling it? And I said, well, one question first. Are you giving your findings to the police? And she said, yes. And I said, well, in that case, no. Because I cannot imagine a more perfect example of McCarthyism. Rat on your colleagues, and the information will be given to the police. Okay, maybe Dame Janet's representative was misspeaking, but if she wasn't misspeaking, this is witch hunting, pure and simple. And again, acquiescence with totalitarianism. So that was three reasons for me to think very lowly of the current management. And then along comes the Tony situation. Now, having been through what I was through and having known so many other innocent people, and I use that to cover not only people who did not get to charge or who were acquitted, but those people who didn't even get to the arrest stage, whom the public don't know about. But I know when your name is put in the public arena in that subject area, it becomes very dangerous, and I've used the expression of bandwagoners. And for the name of Tony Blackburn to be placed into this subject area is to invite bandwagoners, is to put him into a realm in which he does not belong. And it is a very grave decision to make, because you are jeopardizing a man's sanity and legal standing.
I'm just going to butt in and say, I feel good that commercial radio has not gone along with this. I feel good that Tony is allowed to carry on working for Bauer and KMFM and for his other commercial stations. It's, you know, scant, you know, compared to what he had at the BBC. But isn't it great that they haven't run away from this?
Absolutely. And my hat is off to commercial radio for supporting Tony Blackburn. Having said that, my hat is also off to all the managers of Radio 2 below controller level, all of whom have expressed their solidarity with Tony to us. They've made it clear this is not a Radio 2 decision. It's a director general decision with the controller as the hitman. And everybody else at Radio 2 supports Tony Blackburn. It's unanimous.
We used to live in a culture where if that happened, you would say, as a middle management person, I can't take this, I'm off. Wouldn't you resign?
I had a bemusing conversation with Bob Harris the morning after Tony's sacking. And I said, I know from my own experience, no one will go out in support of me. You know, there I was, unfairly off for a year. No one went out and supported me. Tony Blackburn, unfairly sacked. No, and Bob agreed. I said, you know, if we could get a group together, I'd go out. But hey, we're all throwbacks to the 70s. You know, yeah, we'd go out because to us, you stand up for your colleagues. Nope. This is one example of how management has succeeded at the BBC in placing us all in silos. You look back at the days when we had a Radio 1 football team, and you can't believe it. We met each other regularly. We knew every one of us. Now, sometimes, I walk in to do a program, and there's someone sitting in for somebody in front of me, and I feel as if someone's walked in off the street and taken control of the radio station, because I don't recognize this person. We exist in our own silos. So even though everyone that I've spoken to is united in their feeling about Tony, but there's no group. In the old days, it would have been called a union. There are never any presenter meetings. We don't get to meet each other. So there's no possibility of organization unless you tried to organize a campaign via email or something.
Back in the days when you and I worked together at Radio 1, some noisy people would have gone and banged on some big oak doors, wouldn't they? It might have been John Walters.
Oh, sure. Sure.
It might even have been Simon Bates, but it would have been somebody who would have gone up there and said, hang on.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the chasm between talent and management has never been as wide or as deep as it is under the current management. And unfortunately, the current management coterie have reopened and deepened every chasm there has been in my 43 years. The gap between talent and management. We now know, we all know we have no power. We serve only at their discretion. This is not a team effort. The BBC is not a team effort anymore. As one of the producers said to me, we have each other, the people who work on the floor. We do it for each other. We know that the current management team don't care about us. I mean, because another of the great chasms that has been opened up is high culture versus populism. And so you have Tony Royal Opera House Hall v. Tony Top 40 Blackburn. And I cannot be sued for making that dichotomy, because that is a dichotomy that clearly has been presented in the press and in legal circles. Now, we at Radio 2 know that the current management of the BBC dismiss us. And our generation of presenters knows that we're expendable for the reputation of the current management coterie, because they want to blame somebody to say it was all them. Wait a minute. Manhood crosses program type. I love the contribution of Nikki Campbell to the Dame Janet Report, when he said to her, you're focusing on DJs, but what about? And then he named two of the most respected news figures of the generation. And he says she was shocked. You know, the idea that a proper person could, and this is not a suggestion of crime. This is just a suggestion of being touchy-feely in lifts. That's what it is. You know, and it's manifestly obvious that the current management coterie doesn't want news department touched by scandal in any way. But hey, I mean, I hate to say it, but most of the newsmen in the 70s and 80s were men. You know, they weren't news reporters who were also women. You know, you had Kate 80 and a few greats. But despite how we felt at the time, gender equality was not on the cards until recently. And, indeed, your era in the 90s started introducing more women in post. So then it was men, and men are men. And some men do certain things that other men don't. Again, we're not even talking about criminality. We're just talking about being touchy-feely, which now is regarded as being a pest. So the whole thing is beyond travesty. And Port Blackburn is universally regarded at radio level as scapegoat. And it was brilliant, because it was a brilliant maneuver, because all the press attention on the Dame Janet Report was on Tony, rather than on some other interesting things in the later pages of the report. So I said to Bob Harris, I said, who's going to do this show? None of us are going to be a scab. I actually use the word scab. But Tony Blackburn said, my grievance is not with my colleagues, it's with the BBC. So Mark did it for a while, and then I've been asked to do it. And, well, I've been told to do it. I mean, and of course, I will give it my best shot, because it is an important, iconic program, and you have to maintain its integrity. And I figured out a way that I can put myself into it without trying to change the basic nature of the program. So we'll see if I can do that.
Well, everybody wishes you every success, Paul. Thank you very much for being so candid.
Well, you know, the thing is, how can you not? I mean, when you're asked, you know, you don't go around...
Plenty of people wouldn't be as candid, would they? Because they'd think, I don't say this because, you know... It's like the North Korea thing or the, I don't know, the Nazi Germany thing or the Soviet Union thing. You just think, I better just keep my head down.
Well, you see, I've unfortunately been affected by the witch hunt now in various ways. For 2.5 years, actually 3 years, if you have the 6 month run up to my being arrested, when I thought, oh my God, you know, I there's a 50% chance I'm going to, you know, of course I wasted half a year of my life trying to figure out who could complain about me, because when the complaint came, it was from somebody I never knew. But you see, my desire is to, in the near future, get together with some of the others who were in positions similar to mine. And really campaign for anonymity before charge, and then for the prosecution or medical attention of malicious false accusers. And what has happened to this society in the past 5 years is unforgivable, and that the BBC should have been a part of it breaks my heart.
Paul Gambaccini, thank you very much for talking to radio today. If I might borrow one of your lines, we'll have the news now from Stuart Clarkson, and we'll be back in less than 90 seconds.
That's a very good memory. Very good memory.
Broadcast Bionics, solutions for radio, sponsors the Radio Today programme.
OK, the clock's ticking. Here are this week's top industry stories, Trevor. Four bids have been put into Ofcom for the 96.3 FM licence in Glasgow, previously occupied by XFM. Go Radio Glasgow, Original FM, Rock Radio Scotland and Bowers Clyde Rocks have all submitted applications. A study done for Radio Centre has found that commercial radio is worth £683 million a year to the UK economy. It supports more than 12,000 jobs, almost 4,500 of those direct employees by commercial radio stations. And the report prepared by Oxford Economics also finds commercial radio's value to music sales is around £103 million, and for advertisers, the sector provides a return of £7.70 for every pound spent. More details are out about this year's radio festival in London on the 26th of September. LBC's Katie Hopkins, Nick Robinson from the Today programme and Radio 1 presenter Scott Mills among those who'll take to the stage at the British Library. Last week's Local Radio Day has been hailed a great success by the UKRD CEO William Rogers. Almost 60 stations took part. UKRD says the celebration of local radio will return in 2017. Ken Livingstone won't be returning to LBC at the end of his contract. He's been off air in recent weeks following claims he made anti-Semitic remarks in media interviews. He's been co-host of Saturday Mornings on the station with David Meller for the last 4 years and joined LBC back in 2008 originally. Channel 4's Michael Crick has been on with Meller instead recently. And Bowers Network content director Mike Cass is leaving the group at the end of the summer after 18 months. He oversees shared programmes on the City 1 stations, as well as running the Place 2 and Place 3 networks across the north of England and Scotland. Rumour is he's heading for a big programming job in London. Watch this space. More news, of course, daily at radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Stuart Clarkson.
Thank you, Stuart. And by the way, if you were expecting our interview with Will Harding about Global's Academy in this episode, it's been displaced by the Gambo revelations, but we will bring it to you next week. Some radio moments next on this Radio Today programme.
Phone calls, social media, SMS, email, codec control and visualisation through the same interface. Phone box from Broadcast Bionics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
Very few radio presenters last more than two decades on the same station. This one did, and he bid farewell this week just last year.
Most of all, I want to thank you for listening. It has been my privilege and honour to be here talking to you, and I'm really going to miss doing it. What a journey. And I worked it out. I've played 163,064 songs on this show in the last 17 years. But I've got one more for you. Leona Graham will be in this chair on Monday morning. I know you'll be listening, and so will I. Bye-bye.
This week last year, and the final weekday show at least for Russ Williams after 22 years of what was the old Virgin 1215, and then on Absolute Radio. Radio's got quite used to making the headlines, and it surely did this week 13 years ago with Andrew Gilligan's Two Way on the Today programme on Radio 4 about that Iraq dossier.
Downing Street, our source says, ordered a week before publication, ordered it to be sexed up, to be made more exciting, and ordered more facts to be discovered.
When you say more facts to be discovered, does that suggest that they may not have been facts?
Well, our source says that the dossier, as it was finally published...
Andrew Gilligan on Radio 4. That single broadcast referring to a sexed-up dossier was the catalyst for a controversy which was to last years, and one with tragic implications. This week in 1990, from commercial radio, another frequency split as AM and FM in Lancashire were divorced.
We think that's going to be number one shortly. World in Motion from New Order. Now, it's decision time. Will it be 97.4 Red Rose Rock FM or Red Rose Gold on 999 AM? It's time to make your choice now.
So, which shall we have? Let's do the one with the nicest jingles.
Good morning. It's bigger and better than ever. Friday, June the 1st, and this is the new Red Rose Rock FM.
Rock in the Northwest. Rock FM.
The update at 8 o'clock. I'm Paul Kenyon. President Bush and Mr. Gorbachev...
Red Rose splitting its AM from its FM in Lancashire and the creation of Rock FM this week, 26 years ago. This week in 1950, the tapes were anxiously being laced for the playing out of the first pilot episode of a new radio serial from Birmingham.
Mr. Reeford, would you tell them? You see, I...
Yes, and what would you like me to tell them, my dear?
I'm going to have a baby.
It all began, really, I suppose, when I couldn't find any listeners to listen to the standard BBC type of farming programme. And in the meantime, there was this conference in Birmingham to see what country folk wanted in the way of programmes about farming and gardening and country life and what you will. And there was nothing came out of that until... This farmer stood up at the back and said, well, what we farmers want is a farming Dick Barton. Well, of course, everybody burst out laughing, and that was the end of the conference.
The early thinking for The Archers, which was first heard this week 66 years ago, after those pilot episodes, the series proper was to begin 6 months later. Another popular BBC serial ended this week in 1980 after 11 years on Radio 2.
And now here's the final omnibus edition of Wagoner's Walk. George Underdown is unable to do justice to Sophie's cooking, for an extraordinary reason.
A little green man?
That's right.
My goodness.
Yes, I realise it doesn't sound likely.
Wonderful, George.
Why?
The end of Wagoner's Walk on Radio 2 this week 36 years ago. It had been launched originally to replace The Dales. This week in 1990, Terry Waite was in captivity in Beirut. But on his birthday, it was his little radio that gave him hope.
If you can imagine sitting in this cell with this little radio, hearing a message from my family, and you wonder, gosh, where are they now? And yet they still remember.
When I saw Terry, which was very soon after he was released, he said without doubt the most uplifting thing that ever happened to him in the 5 years. To hear of his family, to hear of his to hear my voice and to hear about his own family and how life was going on and not to worry about his frail and ill mother was the greatest piece of broadcasting I'll ever do and prove to me, if I ever needed the proof, of the unique power of radio.
John McCarthy talking on his broadcast to Terry Waite on the World Service this week in 1990. Finally, with all we now know, it's difficult to believe that Jimmy Savile was on the radio for decades, but he was. Radio 1 hired him, and he began his Savile's travels this week in 1968.
And how about that, then, ladies and gentlemen and guys and girls? Welcome indeed to the best of Savile's travels, which is what this is. Meaning that is that we have taken, over the last 8 or 9 months, all our knockout interviews. We're trying to sort out which ones are the best ones, which was very difficult.
How does that sound now? Savile's Travels, which began this week 48 years ago. In the Radio Times, it says Jimmy Savile introduces interviews and records from his weekly world of people, places and pop. So, with Compass FM launched in Grimsby 15 years ago...
We care about the area, and the same issues that concern you concern us.
The death of BBC radio commentator Peter Bromley 13 years ago...
Shagar's going for the guns!
Galaxy launching in the North East 17 years ago...
I'm very, very nervous, yeah, but the flies are going already.
Brian Matthew getting his break with Saturday's Skiffle Club on the live programme 59 years ago...
The only solo girl singer in the top 20... this week.
Foxy presenting his last Hit 40 UK 12 years ago.
Hit 40 UK with Woolworths.
And the final Tony Blackburn breakfast show on Radio 1 43 years ago.
I knew he was taking over my breakfast show, which I considered to be mine, and I wanted it to remain that way.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments.
David Lloyd, now formally a freelance again. I wonder if he'll be back on air soon. Well, that's it for this week. Our thanks to Paul Gambaccini, to Stuart Clarkson, researcher Hayley Hayes, and of course you for listening. I've been Trevor Down. This was a TDC production, and it will be followed next week by another one. See you then.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.